Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss a new study by Denfeld et al. Titled, A Primer on Incorporating Sex as a Biological Variable into the Conduct and Reporting of Basic and Clinical Research Studies. This article was published on February 8, 2022 as part of our call for papers on considering sex as a biological variable in cardiovascular research. Joining me today are consulting editor, Dr. Austin Robinson, first author, Dr. Quinn Denfeld, and content expert, Dr. Judy Regensteiner. Let's get started.
Thank you for the introduction, Kara. First off, I'd like to thank both Quinn and Judy for sharing their expertise with us today on the podcast. For a bit of context leading into this episode, AJP Heart and Circ Editor-in-Chief Mary Lindsay and the rest of the editorial team at AJP Heart and Circ penned an editorial entitled Reinforcing Rigor and Reproducibility Expectations for Use of Sex and Gender in Cardiovascular Research that was published last September. And Nisha Sharkoudian hosted a corresponding podcast with the authors. Please check out the editorial and the corresponding podcast in the podcast description for today's episode. Around the same time, AJP Heart and Circ also started a call for papers focused on sex as a biological variable. Some of the more important points raised in the editorial include how far we have come when it comes to studying women's health and how far we still have to go. Specific points included that in 1993, the National Institutes of Health enacted the Revitalization Act to establish guidelines for inclusion of women and minorities in clinical research. Yet these populations remain understudied today, about 30 years later. Another point was that in 2016, the NIH launched an initiative to enhance rigor and reproducibility of research findings, which included the expectation that all applicants, so anyone submitting an NIH grant, proposing animal or human experiments would factor in sex as a biological variable to their experimental design, data analysis, and reporting, or otherwise provide strong scientific justification for the use of only one sex in their approach. Another important point for the editorial was to provide an update on reporting and use of sex as a biological variable for AJP Heart and Circ readers. The authors focused the article on feedback from reviewers who had voiced some frustration with repeatedly seeing papers that did not include sex as a biological variable. The editorial also focused on providing authors with resources to look up definitions and differences between the terms sex and gender, the influence of sex chromosomes versus hormones on physiology, and the role of gender roles on health. For example, they referred to the Sex and Gender Equity and Research, or SAGER, guidelines. Some of the key findings were that most of the articles in AJP Heart and Circ at least reported sex and gender, but a fairly large percentage of the studies were still only using male participants or male animals. The issue of using males only seemed to be a bigger issue with animal studies, with over half of the studies in 2019 and 2021 using males only, whereas human studies, 25% used male only in 2019, and that improved to 7% in 2021. Effective January 2023, AJP Heart and Circ will not accept papers with only one sex or gender without strong rationale. Additionally, potential sex and gender differences must be addressed in the introduction and discussion of all papers. That brings us to today's guest, Dr. Quinn Denfeld, who recently published a paper for the call for papers on sex as a biological variable. The focus of the paper by Quinn and her colleagues was to use the paper as a primer or a practical how-to paper for researchers in the field to start implementing sex as a biological variable in their research. Quinn and Judy are both experts in this area, and I'm looking forward to having them share their insights with AJP Heart and Circ podcast listenership. Quinn's research, along with her former postdoc mentor, Dr. Beth Habecker's research, is translational in nature, and their paper is relevant to both animal and human physiologists. Quinn, can you provide a brief background for the listeners on your research agenda and how you specifically came to be interested in sex differences?
Sure, I would be delighted to provide a brief background to how I got here. And I first want to say thank you for inviting me to be a part of this podcast. I would say that my interest in sex and gender differences stems from way back when I was a bedside nurse in the cardiac and surgical intensive care unit. So there I noticed some distinct differences in how women and men responded to therapies, even though we were treating them mostly the same. So for example, one of our goals was to optimize hemodynamic numbers for our patients. And anecdotally speaking, I would see that this improvement would overall improve the symptom profile for men, but not so much for women. So that and many other examples from my clinical practice got me thinking about how we really should rethink how we understand and treat cardiovascular disease among women. So then fast forward a couple of years, or a number of years rather, to when I was a postdoc fellow in Dr. Beth Haubicker's lab, I decided to apply for a career development award through our institutional Building Interdisciplinary Careers in Women's Health Research K-12 program at OHSU. We call this the Birch Award, and this is how I'll refer to it hereafter. So I decided at that time to avail myself of this opportunity and take a deep dive into the sex differences in physical frailty phenotypes and heart failure. This was an understudied area at the time, and it's just an emerging area now. So I was very fortunate to be funded by the Birch Program, and it really catalyzed my interest and my inquiry into sex differences in this particular area, frailty and heart failure. But it also catalyzed my overall interest in sex and gender differences more broadly, including how to help this field grow. So I want to point out here how the Birch Program, which is funded by the Office of Research in Women's Health, has multiple sites across the country at many institutions, and one of which is led by Judy at the University of Colorado. So I would highly recommend these career development awards in the early career phase.
Great. So thanks for telling us about the Birch Award. Another thing that I thought was interesting was how you and the authors framed your paper as a practical how-to paper. So after seeing the AJP Heart and Circ call for papers, can you describe how your group's motivation came together to write that paper and just kind of provide a brief overview of the paper?
Definitely. So I noticed the AJP Heart Circ editorial and the call for papers. It really stood out to me, and I felt that it was a call to action that we should all heed, especially in the publication space. At the same time, I also thought, well, people still may not have concrete ideas for how to do this, even though, as you mentioned earlier, the mandate to include women and consider sex as a biological variable in studies has been in place for a while. So because I was trained to consider this from the get-go in both my PhD studies with Dr. Christopher Lee and my postdoc studies with Dr. Haubicker, and then given my recent career development award through the Birch and my ongoing work in my lab, I thought I would take the opportunity to offer some humble ideas based on how we've done it in the past. And we approached this paper with the goal of demystifying this issue of addressing sex as a biological variable. And to say, sure, it does take a little bit of time and planning and foresight, but here are some ways that we've done this. So in this paper, which includes both Drs. Lee and Haubicker as co-authors, we simply describe how we have done this on both the basic side and the clinical side of research. So that was really the impetus to bring this paper to you guys.
In the paper, you mentioned that some of Dr. Haubicker's early studies were done exclusively in male rats. Do you know around what year those studies were being conducted and when your group made the switch to start focusing on including both sexes in all of the studies?
Yes. So Dr. Haubicker's lab was using male rats previously, and they published this paper using this model in 2004 in AJP Heart Circ. But then after that, they switched to using both male and female mice. So in the mid early 2000s, when they had to breed transgenic mice, they didn't see any reason to toss half the mice. So they simply started working with both male and female rodents. And then they figured that if a sex difference came up, they would explore it later. So they have been doing this for a number of years and have decided to continue to use it because there was no reason not to.
We often hear about the challenges of including both male and female rodents or male and female animals. Can you maybe touch on some of the benefits of using both male and female rodents or male and female animals just to start your study?
Yes. So one of the main benefits that they saw was that they were able to use all of the bred mice in their studies, not just half of them. So that was beneficial on a number of levels, including saving money and resources. And then Dr. Habecker's team over the years, using both male and female mice, they were able to see whether some physiological findings were similar or different between the female and male mice. And often they weren't much different. So that is good to know. It's good to know that the things that we're seeing in the lab are similar in both female and male mice. So it's good to know if something occurs similarly or differently in males and females. So I would say that's one of the main benefits of using both of them in addition to saving money and resources.
Thanks, Quinn. I agree that sometimes we focus more on what's different, but I think it's also really important to know when different physiological factors are not different between the sexes as well. Judy, the authors of the paper mentioned that the NIH has required the inclusion of sex as a biological variable since 2016. I think it's also worth pointing out that the NIH initially established policies that encouraged researchers to include women in studies all the way back in 1986. Yet we still see studies today that include only men or only males. What are some of the common reasons that you hear from researchers in animal science or in clinical science that they give for not including sex as a biological variable in their studies?
I want to be clear that there's almost never a valid reason to exclude one sex scientifically from a study. So that's important to know. And one of the most common things that I hear is if you include both sexes, won't it be too expensive? Because it'll double your sample size. And in reality, to not include both sexes can end up being more expensive because the data may not be as valuable and you can lose the possible impact of your work. For instance, missteps in drug development might occur while you have results that are valid in men but not in women, and then you might not know how well a drug works in women. However, if cost is a concern, then there are other ways perhaps to account for not including as many animals or people in a study. And these can include, as Quinn notes in her paper, these can include statistical adjustments, for instance, and there can be propensity score analyses, interaction terms, moderation analyses. So there are statistical ways to look at this, but ideally, both sexes should be included in studies. Some people say it's too difficult to include both sexes. People often, I've seen this as a grant reviewer and as an author for journal articles, they'll say, well, you know, we'll include men now, and then later we'll study women as well, is most typically what I see. And that doesn't get a good response from a reviewer looking for appropriate inclusion of both men and women, as you can imagine. It doesn't make sense to exclude women, and it shouldn't be done.
Thanks, Judy. Quinn, going back to Dr. Habecker's early animal work, you mentioned that the group didn't necessarily expect to see a sex difference in some of the parameters of interest, but that if you did see a difference, or if the group did see a difference, you could then explore underlying mechanisms later. I think many researchers only consider the downside of needing to consider sex as a biological variable, and Judy just dismissed several of those misconceptions. But can you expand upon how including both sexes may actually give researchers additional questions that they can explore or pursue future funding opportunities for?
Absolutely. So I think these mandates often inject fear in us when we really need to think of them as an opportunity. So this might be an opportunity to research an area that is unexplored or underexplored. And frankly, many areas of cardiovascular disease among women are unexplored or underexplored. So as I mentioned before, seeing some sex differences in my early data gave me enough of a signal to write the next grant that was specifically focused on sex differences. So I had seen that there were some higher rates of frailty among women compared with men. And I just took a sneak peek at it. And by taking a sneak peek at it with a slightly different lens, and also looking at the literature with a slightly different lens, this resulting work, by just noticing this one signal, actually opened up so many opportunities. And so all it really required was just shifting my lens a little bit. So I want to highlight too here that science is really an iterative process. So we are not supposed to answer all the questions right away. We are supposed to build on our findings step by step. So not every study has to be powered to examine sex differences. And as Judy mentioned, there are some statistical approaches that you can take to account for some of these. And many studies won't be. In fact, many of my studies just haven't been. But the main point here is to consider sex as a biological variable. You don't necessarily have to explain it, but you have to consider it. So I want to circle back and say that by considering sex as a biological variable and taking a look at these data in a different way, that has since opened up opportunities, including applying for the Birch program and being funded by them for my career development award. So I want to highlight that, yes, these shifts and these pivots do require some work and some changes, but sometimes change can be good and it can open up opportunities.
Sometimes when you include women, you can get supplements to study sex differences. So look around. More and more funders are looking at the possibility of including women in studies more frequently and are maybe willing to support that. So your world may be opened up, as Quinn notes as well. And, you know, don't be afraid to start with small pilot data, a small sample size, because you might just get a signal that leads you to a very exciting new direction.
I would like to hear from both Quinn and Judy on this next question. So with me being an early stage investigator, I wonder if you have any recommendations for early career researchers or individuals who are potentially in a lab that does not have a lot of resources on how to best approach sex as a biological variable from a pilot data perspective. So specifically, let's say that you want to use an expensive molecular biology technique or an expensive or time-intensive approach in clinical research. Do you think it would be best to collect your pilot data in both sexes and build upon that? Or do you think there are some cases where it would be best to try to minimize variability when submitting a grant proposal? For example, if you can only collect data on 5 or 6 animals or 5 or 6 human participants?
Yes, that's a very good question. And it is very challenging for early stage investigators when you are extremely limited in time and resources and frankly, money. But for me, what I think of when I think of sex as a biological variable, it's just one of many variables that can introduce variability into a research project, just like age or severity of disease. So I work with humans, and frankly, sex is just is honestly the least of my concerns sometimes, because we have many other variables that can introduce a lot of heterogeneity in our samples. So I consider it as something that just needs to be considered in my project alongside everything else. So across studies, I do recognize there is a need to minimize variability by restricting things like severity of disease. But we have to recognize by doing this, we then can't tease apart some of these effects on the outcomes. And sometimes it sets us up for incomplete findings. And so as Judy mentioned before, there's really no good reason to not include both sexes unless you are working in a specific disease state that only affects one particular sex. So it is a bit of a challenge, and there's always that balance between ensuring that you're adequately set up to find or not find the thing that you're looking for, but also ensuring proper generalizability. So I would say, personally, I would suggest including both sexes in a small pilot study, but then consider limiting other sources of variation, like maybe the age of mice, or maybe the methods that you're using in a wet lab, or if you're doing a clinical research study, limiting your sample to a very particular disease state. So yes, that will limit the generalizability, but it might limit the variability in your methods. So, you know, people may think that sex and gender is going to be an incredible source of variability, but honestly, it may not be the biggest concern. And if you are approaching your study design with a rigorous approach, making sure that you're collecting data appropriately and analyzing appropriately, it honestly probably will be one of the least concerns when you're actually looking at your data.
I really like what Quinn had to say on that topic. I would also just say to you to think about including both sexes as the norm and what you should do, and then figuring out, you know, again, if you're a young researcher, go in with small sample sizes and look for signals, maybe rather than definitive findings, and see what you see and let that process unfold. And look for small grants to help you. Also, look for pilot funding, which is often available to early career investigators, and be creative in trying to get some funding to do this kind of work.
Thanks, Quinn and Judy. I think those are all great insights. Quinn, as you mentioned, I think a lot of times researchers will focus on sex as a variable that could introduce some variability in their data. But I think there's a lot of physiological factors such as age, disease severity, which you mentioned. We could also think about things like health behaviors, socioeconomic status, social determinants of health. So there are a number of factors. And as Judy mentioned earlier, I think to really boost the validity of your findings, you would definitely want to include both sexes, even if it's just pilot data. And so for a follow-up question, this is more for actual manuscripts, not just pilot data per se. If a group does have a small sample size, but it includes both sexes or genders, what are your thoughts on plotting the data with unique symbols, such as squares versus circles, or delineating based off color, like if you used white and black or in different colors to represent different sexes? I was recently asked to do this for an APS journal, and while it was a little extra work, I do think it's a great idea. And it might allow other researchers who read that paper to do sex-specific power analyses or get an idea of potential sex differences or lack thereof.
Yes, so I think that's a great idea. So sure, it may be a little bit of extra work to plot the data or to look at it with a different analysis, but you never know what kind of cool things you might unearth by looking at these plots. So as I mentioned, I had reviewed some earlier data that I had published on, and when I found a substantial sex difference, even though it wasn't significant, we had a small sample size and even smaller numbers of women, it gave me enough signal to say, let's pursue this further. So that goes back to just looking at the data in a slightly different lens and thinking of what opportunities might lie beyond that. So yes, it is an add-on, a sensitivity analysis that might be a little bit more work, but again, it might open up opportunities.
I really like the idea. And as people more and more may be required by journals and by funders to consider both sexes, people like yourself who may be already starting to focus on both sexes will be ahead of the game and we'll have to think in new ways. This whole effort is making us think in new and exciting ways about, you know, both sexes, what we're going to learn and what we will gain from that knowledge. It's really pretty exciting. So in a way, we're at a pioneering time and we'll have lots to gain through doing this. So a little extra work, I understand, but it might really well be worth it.
Quinn and Judy, can you provide some specific examples where we need to particularly include females or women? When I was reading the article, I was really surprised to learn that only 1 in 5 left ventricular assist devices are implanted in women.
Yes, and that is really surprising to me as well. So I think in our lack of data on relevant sex differences, and again, also sex similarities, has set up a vicious cycle where we have an imbalanced knowledge base. So we don't know as much about women compared with men. And unfortunately, this has translated to an imbalanced evidence base. So as a result, the armamentarium of treatment options, it actually benefits men much more than women. So that means that it's on us as scientists to consider how we can build this knowledge base from all levels of science, from basic to preclinical to clinical, so that we can in turn inform the clinical evidence base. So as you mentioned, one of the most profound sex gender differences that I've seen is in this implantation of left ventricular assist devices. So this has been an ongoing issue in heart failure. And first, it was because women were considered too small. Their body size was too small for the devices. But now we have devices that can accommodate women's smaller sizes. And even though we do have these new devices, we still see significant sex and gender differences. And so there could be many reasons for this, and we could take up a couple hours long discussion discussing this, but we really should tackle this subject and start by seeing what's happening with women and men who receive a left ventricular assist device. So one of the papers that I reference in here is one that I took a look, and yes, it was imbalanced. We still had a predominantly male sample, but we had enough women that we were able to approach this a sample and this analysis by saying, okay, how do these markers, these echocardiographic and biomarkers change after left ventricular assist device implantation, as well as symptoms. And we saw some similarities, in fact. So it's good to know how that women are actually responding similarly to men. Of course, we're going to need to continue to to study this, but it really just helps us to take a look at these data, provide some starting points for future research, and then hopefully this will offer some evidence for clinical decision-making that will help rectify this imbalance in clinical practice.
That's a really great example, Quinn, but it goes even more broadly. There are currently very, very few sex-specific guidelines guiding clinical care for women and men. So still to this day, if you go in to receive treatment for blood pressure and you're a woman, the data that you will be treated by primarily result from studies in men. And many cases, the drugs may work the same in men and women, but in many cases, this also might not be the case. And we don't have the evidence to guide sex-specific guidelines. There hasn't been enough recruitment into some of the blood pressure studies that were supposed to establish clinical sex-specific guidelines. And so most of the data governing most medical care for most conditions is developed on data from men only. And so the challenge is in front of us to gather these data so that clinical health care for both men and women is optimized.
So Judy, as you were speaking, another question came to mind. Let's just say you are a researcher and you're trying to balance your study for sex or gender, and it just so happens that there's a bit of an imbalance, like Quinn had mentioned in one of her prior studies. If you want to take some extra time to try to balance your study, is that a valid reason for something like a no-cost extension and a grant?
Absolutely. If you think that you won't have the power if you don't aren't recruiting as well, and because women, it's been shown in some studies, are harder to recruit to study clinical studies than men, I think most funders would recognize this as a very valid reason. I personally wouldn't hesitate to ask, and I think it would be very much respected. I would still ask, of course, I wouldn't assume it, but I would expect that under recruitment is a reason for a no-cost extension.
I just also want to point out that, yes, it is challenging sometimes to recruit women, or it may be challenging to make sure you have an adequate sample size, but there are resources out there and people do want to help you achieve that. So I was able to secure a third year of support on the Birch, in part because I needed to reach my 50-50 balance sample. So I actually had to close my study to men for the last 5 months of my recent study because I needed to focus my efforts on women. And we were able to achieve that, but it did take a little bit of extra time and I did need to seek out extra support, but it did allow me to do that. And then I also want to point out what Judy mentioned before, is that NIH and other funding organizations are there to help you optimize your samples and enhance them and make sure that you have an adequate number of women or females. So reach out, look for opportunities like calls for applications or supplements or other things that might help you augment your study.
I think that will be really good advice for some of the listeners out there who are interested in making sure that they balance their studies. Again, a question for both of you, and Quinn touched on this in the article. We know that the NIH is also interested in ensuring that we study diverse participant pools. AJP Heart and Circ also had a recent call for papers last year on racial disparities in cardiovascular and cerebrovascular function. Are either of you aware of any initiatives or resources out there that are specifically geared towards the inclusion of more women who are also minorities, as they are particularly underrepresented in research?
Yes, there are some initiatives and resources out there that are geared toward helping to enhance our sample size and enrich them with women, especially those who are underrepresented in research. So for example, there's a recent notice of special interest on U3 populations of women. So those who are underrepresented, underreported, and understudied. And the Office of Research in Women's Health is offering supplements to existing awards to help reach out and connect studies with resources and ensure that they have the support that they need to connect with women who may be underrepresented in research. So for example, if, as we've talked about in heart failure, clinical studies have traditionally and historically been imbalanced such that only about 30% of heart failure samples are comprised of women. So if one wants to think about this, they could consider applying for some of these notice of special interest to enhance and enrich their population and make sure that they get to the 50-50 balance perhaps that they're looking for, or retaining women in studies too. That's been another issue, is women may be willing to participate in research, but then they may not have the time to do it. So especially during these pandemic times, it's been difficult for women to do a lot of things. And so doing studies is probably low on their priority list. So thinking of ways and grant opportunities and funding mechanisms that can allow you to do some of these approaches and bring women into the study and keep them in the study would be really beneficial.
Quinn mentioned the Office of Research of Women's Health. I'm on their advisory board, and I can tell you that involving more diverse populations, both as scientists and as participants in studies, is a huge focus of importance. So please look to their website so that you can see what resources are offered by them.
Quinn, you made an important point in the paper about documenting some of the challenges we face as researchers when it comes to recruitment and retention of particular populations, and potentially even publishing the resultant findings. That seems like a great idea for helping other researchers anticipate or avoid some of the potential pitfalls. Could you provide examples or some ideas regarding this point?
Definitely. So my general approach is that I figure if I'm having trouble with something in science, there's probably going to be someone else who is having the same trouble. So maybe let's learn from each other so we don't face the same challenges. So recently, as I mentioned in my Birch study, we had difficulties recruiting women into the study to achieve our 50-50 balance. So I put it out there that we had difficulties doing this, and that one method was just to simply close enrollment to men. And so while it did extend the duration of the study, it allowed us to get to that point. I think it's important to recognize some of this and to account for some of these potential pitfalls and these potential delays. And so being aware of this in our grant applications is important. And then more recently, we have been having difficulties keeping women in our studies. As I mentioned before, the pandemic has wreaked a lot of havoc on people, especially women. And so participating in research has been difficult. And so I think it's important to outline some of these difficulties and challenges, and that maybe perhaps we can learn from this. Maybe we can put on a different lens, think a little bit differently outside the box, and meet women where they're at, maybe doing study visits in their homes, doing some more remote data collection, things like that. So I think it's important for us to pool our resources. We've done this with COVID and trying to shift all of our research studies in these times. So just as we've been doing with COVID, let's think about how we can do this to enhance and enrich our samples with women and females.
While you were speaking, I was thinking about how that was such a great idea to just try to formally document some of the challenges we face when it comes to recruitment. I feel like oftentimes these are things that you might discuss when you see someone at a conference or through email, but by having them out there for everyone to kind of see and potentially learn from, I think it will help others avoid some of the same issues. Lastly, Judy, I wanted to ask you about any resources, particularly those provided by the Office of Research on Women's Health, that you would recommend for listeners. So for example, prior to preparing for this podcast, I was not aware of the Birch program that Quinn mentioned. So are there any other particular programs that you wanted to highlight?
Yes, absolutely, Austin. And by the way, the Birch program is available both to female and male scholars. I would say probably over 80% of the participants have been women, but this is changing and more men are getting interested in women's health and sex differences research. So the Birch is open to both men and women. And it's a wonderful program that provides a lot of support and mentoring, as well as, you know, academic development. The Office of Research on Women's Health has excellent resources and really focuses on that. These include workshops, courses, and fairly recently, a primer on SABV that is available to all at no cost. So anyone can sign on, register on their website, and take this primer, which talks about both sex and gender. So you can learn about both of those concepts, which is really important. I'm actually requiring my Birch scholars to take the primer, and I think it's so helpful as well. The ORWH two flagship programs are the Birch program and also the SCORE, which is Sex Differences in Women's Health. And that program, the SCORE program, is based on the science of women's health sex differences research and does have an educational component in that a scholar is involved as well. two really big and wonderful programs focused on women's health and sex differences research. So lots of resources. I'm sure that Kara will include the website, and they're all free. And they also tell you of a lot of grant opportunities, such as the NOSI that Quinn talked about on U3 populations of women and others.
So to wrap it up, I'd like to give either of you an opportunity to just provide any additional points that you'd like to make.
Okay, I'll make a couple of points. I want to emphasize that women's health remains significantly understudied. When you start looking at the data, as I have, there is very little known relative to what we need to know about women's health. I love sex differences research as well, because then you can study both men and women. Then you can learn things that will benefit both sexes. But of the two, women's health is significantly more understudied, and we have a lot more work to do in that area. So it's a great career field for a young researcher, I would think. I'd like to encourage you to include sex and gender concepts into your research. There are now papers published that tell you how to do this. Quinn's excellent paper gives you very practical advice on this area as well. I think it's such an important and exciting area of study.
I agree, and I want to echo a few points. First, women's health is still understudied, and I cannot believe we are looking at 2022 and we still don't have the evidence base to support women. So I will echo that it is important to consider sex as a biological variable and gender, and to look at this in your research, because if we all just start adding a little bit to our knowledge base by each group, by each individual PI, by each researcher, I think we will make monumental strides in understanding women's health and sex differences. And it will also benefit men as well. So I would love to just end with a couple of thoughts, because I recognize, as someone who is still very early in my career, I recognize that just making these tweaks can be challenging. So I would recommend to researchers that the first step, I guess the easiest one, and I know it may not be super easy, but you have to include both sexes and genders in your study and your publication, just as AJP Heart and Circ is requiring you to, unless scientifically justifiable not to. But really, there's very few reasons not to do it. So as Judy has mentioned before, I want to underscore that, include both sexes and genders in there. And in order to do that, I know it may take a little bit of time, planning and foresight, but please do that. And then the second step beyond that, if you want to just build upon that, is to explore the data a bit more, just as we talked about earlier. Plot the data, do some sex stratified analyses, look at the data just with a slightly different lens, because as Judy mentioned, sex and gender difference research, women's health research is a great field to be in, and you might find something in there that you could pursue with future research and apply for more funding for. And then the third step is to leverage your existing resources, especially the ones that Judy mentioned from the Office of Research on Women's Health. There are resources out there. There are programs out there, and scholars and researchers like myself and Judy and others who have done this, and we are willing to help. So the literature also has a lot of information on this, so explore that. So I would encourage people to just think about it as one more variable, that it may yield some really cool findings and some opportunities for future work.
Thank you both so much for sharing your expertise and insights. For all of our listeners, please be sure to read Quinn's paper, check out the links in the podcast description, and refer to all of the papers in the AJP Heart and Circ Call for Papers on Sex as a Biological Variable to learn more about this topic and to learn more about some of the concrete recommendations that you can use to include sex as a biological variable in your own research.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ Podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.